Many gardeners and farmers purchase their seeds each year from seed companies, yet it hasn't always been that way. Seed saving is a practice as old as agriculture itself. Today's guest, Dan Brisbois, writes in his new book, "All the seeds you sow are only here due to the work of countless generations of seed keepers that came before you." What does it take to join this legacy and become a seed keeper? Today on Common Ground Radio, we'll discuss seed stewardship and growing and saving your own seed. I'm Holly Cederholm, your host for a conversation about local food and organic agriculture brought to you by the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. I'm joined by Dan Brisbois, an organic farmer in Quebec, Canada, with 20 years of experience growing seed. Dan is the host of the Seed Farmer podcast and the author of the newly released book, The Seed Farmer. Tournesol Cooperative Farm, where Dan is one of several farmers, produces organic seeds, which the farm sells through an online seed store. Dan, welcome to Common Ground Radio.
It's great to be here.
Let's start by learning a little more about your background with seeds. How and why did you start working with seeds?
So I didn't really think much about seeds when I started farming. I was working as an apprentice on an organic vegetable farm. And, you know, growing vegetables was kind of new to me, even though we'd gardened when I was young. And I went to visit another farm close by, and there was a couple apprentices there who were obsessed with seeds. And on one of the times I was there, they were threshing some red Russian kale that had overwintered. And it just, I was so intrigued. And that's where I kind of got, you know, introduced to it. And then I started to see seeds everywhere. These, like, you know, plants that were escaping left and right, rutabaga that hadn't been tilled under well, or lettuces that had gone up to flower. Like, I just started seeing them everywhere and started made the connection with the fact that we plant seeds and they come from somewhere and they could come from us. And not to say that they should come from us, all of them, but that they could come from us.
So while your book and podcast are dedicated to seed farming, the information you share is also useful to gardeners who may not have any interest in selling seed. However, the practices for growing and using the seed will remain more or less the same, though perhaps at a different scale. In part one of your new book, The Seed Farmer, you describe the importance of observation and cultivating what you call a first seed mindset. What is this mindset and why do you recommend this approach?
So I recommend this approach because, you know, people come to be interested in seed in a lot of different ways. Often they're ways that are a little bit like doomsday thinking, you know, like you find out about biodiversity being lost, you start thinking about seed security, seed sovereignty. Sometimes they're also really wonderful stories, like that you're trying to reconnect with your agricultural and your culinary traditions and your ancestral foods. And suddenly it feels like if you don't do this right, biodiversity is not going to work. And I think that that's a bit heavy to have on your shoulders. And so, yes, we have all kinds of reasons why we want to start working with seed. But at the base, I think it's important that you just try it out and just start to work with seed. And so that first seed mindset is to forget about the reasons that you're doing it. And then also, you might have heard about, you know, the problems with cross-pollination and how you can ruin something if two different things cross. And if you've read a bit more, you've heard you need to have so many plants to have a population size to avoid inbreeding depression. And not that those are not really important concepts, but they're not going to help you when you're starting. And they're also, you probably can't do that much stuff that's going to ruin a seed in the short term. That first seed mindset is to sort of forget about all the rules that you may have read and just watch plants go to flower, then go to seed, and then figure out how to get it off, even if it's a bit painstaking. You have to get that seed out of there and then harvest it and then grow it out the next year. And then as you grow it out, you'll start to see maybe you should have paid attention to cross-pollinating. So if it's in a farming perspective and you're growing 1,000 tomato plants and you only grow 50 from your own stuff, your own seed, you're not compromising your whole planting. And so just starting small. And what I get into later a bit is if you have a variety, there's a named variety and the story or you want to keep it exactly like it is, yes, you need to be careful about cross-pollination. But I think in most cases, it's okay to have a bit of cross-pollination. And that's where we can start to see new opportunities and select new varieties. And maybe I'm getting ahead of the conversation here as I'm saying this, but yeah, that first seed mindset lets you develop a relationship with the plants that you then just build on from there. And so just starting small without worrying about making mistakes.
So I did want to start jumping right into all the botanical concepts that these new might need to learn. So what is going to help them starting out? You mentioned observing the plant, watching it set seed. So what are some kind of practices or tenets that a first-time seed grower can embody with this first seed mindset?
Well, I think it's really good to know if your plant is an annual or a biennial. And an annual is a plant that you're going to start it in the spring. It's going to produce a vegetable, maybe a lettuce or a tomato plant, and then it's going to go to flower and seed, I guess, especially in the case of a lettuce. And then you can get the seed. And then after that, the plant dies. So it just lives 1 year. Whereas a biennial in the first year, it's going to produce usually a storage root like a carrot, a beet, or an onion, or maybe chard or kale. And then you have to overwinter that. And then the next year you'll get seed. So knowing that distinction right away lets you know whether you're going to get seed in that year. But then also, if you're doing an annual, you've got to start, especially in our climate, kind of the Northeast US, Canada, if you don't start early enough, the season might not be long enough to get your seed to mature. And you want your seed both to mature in time, but also you want it to mature before it starts to get wet in the fall. So that's one concept is annual or biennial, and then plant annuals as early as they can handle the frost. Another concept is, and this is a little bit advanced, but it's not too advanced, but is the difference between self-pollinating crops and cross-pollinating crops that we call selfers and crossers informally. And crossers are plants that are going to cross-pollinate much more easily if they're side by side. And selfers, because they mostly self-pollinate themselves, don't cross-pollinate as much. And if you grow two selfers side by side, you might see less than 5% crossing. You might not even see any crossing. And it's important to remember, this is really, really important. You only see crossing the next year. The fruit that grows on a plant that's crossed looks like the parent plant. It doesn't look like the crossed up thing it might be. It's in the DNA that there's a cross. And then when you grow out the seed, that's when you'll see the diversity. So with selfers, you'll see in that next generation very little crossing. And that means you don't really have to worry about isolation distance. And there's not a lot of selfers. There's like tomatoes, lettuce, beans, peas, escarole, for those who know what that is. You know, some of the grains are pretty strong selfers. Peppers and eggplants are, I call them intermediate selfers, which means they cross a little bit more, but they're still pretty selfers. There's about a dozen of them. These crops, for the most part, I wouldn't worry about cross about pollination, about isolation distance. The one exception is watch out with pepper, sweet peppers and hot peppers because they can cross together. And I would grow those like 200 feet apart. But otherwise, I wouldn't worry about isolation distance. And then so that's selfers. And then pretty much everything else is crossers. And so those are going to cross-pollinate. And that, if you want to see next to no crossing, in most areas, 1,200 feet is more than enough distance to not see any crossing. And if you grow them 600 feet apart, maybe you're going to see like 10% crossing. If you grow them side by side, you will see 50% plus crossing. So if it's a crosser, and most things are, then either if you're going to grow two crossers of the same species, you got to have them at 1,000 feet apart. But in almost all cases, you're the one who's going to be planting them. So if you want to have two brassicas and they're the same species, well, then you grow them to 1,000 feet apart, or just grow one brassica. Don't grow two brassicas. The biggest challenge with that is squash, because folks grow so many different types of squash, and many of them will cross-pollinate together. So those are two concepts. Do you want me to go for more? Is that enough to
Well, I think one, when you were talking about how genetics might show up the following year if things get crossed up, I think one that might be helpful for folks is the distinction between open pollinated and hybrid. So when they're starting with their seed, what do those terms mean when they're purchasing seed, and why is that important for seed saving?
Yeah, that's what I should have started with. I usually do. I forgot that. Thanks, Holly. When you're looking in books or seed catalogs, each crop has a scientific name. So like cucumbers or Cucumis mello. And two crops of the who have the same scientific name will generally cross together, and two crops with different scientific names generally won't. It's not 100% true, but it's usually true. And so when we're talking about cross-pollination, That's what we're looking for often is two things with different scientific names. You know, sometimes books mislabel things and sometimes names change. But without that caveat. So open pollinated is when you have a variety and it's not close to another variety of the same species. Okay. So you're not introducing unwanted crossing. But if you just have the variety isolated from other varieties of the same species and you keep seed from that, the next year it's going to give you the same thing. And then if you keep seed from that, the following year it's going to give you the same thing. So it's a variety that breeds true to type. Now, a hybrid is, here's a simple definition of a hybrid, is that you have two lines that are crossed together, two lines of the same species generally, and they'll cross together, give you something that's fairly uniform. That's the F1 hybrid. But if you keep the seed from that F1 hybrid, you're going to get all kinds of different things that following generation. So market gardeners buy a lot of hybrid seed. Home gardeners might be buying it, but not realizing it. And if you're going to get into growing seed or harvesting some of your own seed, I would recommend making sure you do that from open pollinated varieties because then they'll be true to type the next year. They'll be the same thing you started with. Whereas if you take a hybrid, and it might have been a good variety that you use, but you keep the seed and you grow it out, the next year it might look very different from what you started with. And it's going to look like different combinations of the parent plant. It's not that it's bad seed, it's just not what you're expecting to get. So go with the OP, which is short for open pollinated.
So speaking of like some of the starting things to look for, if someone is a grower in the Northeast and they've decided they want to do seed saving for the first time, so they're looking for an open pollinated crop, maybe they've decided to do a self-pollinated or one of the intermediate kind of selfers to start. But then there's also wet seeded versus dry seeded. So we said we didn't want to get too hung up on all the different botanical classifications, but for a beginner seed grower, why might the type of seed, specifically in our wet, humid northeastern climate, be important to consider?
So wet-seeded crops are crops that are usually in a wet, fleshy fruit. So like tomatoes, peppers, squash, cucumbers. And when you're extracting the seed, you can use water without problem because they're already starting wet. So you're not going to make them accidentally germinate. You're not going to introduce disease by that process. So that's one thing. And I'll come back to them in a moment. And then dry-seeded crops are crops that when they mature on the plant, they're dry and brittle. So if you think about like if you've ever grown coriander or dill in your garden, that's like a dry seeded crop. Or if you've dried beans, those are dry seeded crops. These crops, when you're extracting them, you do not want to add water because you can damage the seed and or maybe force it to germinate. So that's a big distinction is how they're cleaned. But then also we sort of in the Northeast, we live in a climate that's fairly hot in the summer most years. I know it's not always, but often on the hotter side, not as hot as some places, but on the hotter side. And it can get wet. Even the dry years can feel humid. And even a dry year, you can suddenly have moisture that appear, like rain that comes. And so for a wet-seeded crops, all those wet-seeded crops actually like hot climate. They come from hotter areas and they like it here. So they grow well in our climate. And then also, they don't mind the humidity falling on them. It's not going to damage the seed. We're a good place for wet-seeded crops as long as they can mature in time. Now, dry-seeded crops, you might think it's the opposite. They're not as good. And that's not totally true. And with dry-seeded crops, there's another distinction to make is it in a pod, like a bean or a pea or a brassica? Or is it what's called naked seed? And so naked seed would be like dill or cilantro is just a seed exposed out in the wild. But lettuce is also a naked seed. It's kind of in like a little cup on the top of the plant. And that cup could gather water if it falls into it and it's exposed right to the seed. Something like beets or chard are naked seed. They're just exposed there. And even like onions, they do have little wrappers, but they are, you know, I would call them naked seed. I don't know if they're technically they're called, but I would call them that. And so seed that comes in pods usually are much easier in our climate, and you'll have usually more success than the naked seeded ones. Not to say you can't have success with the naked seeded ones. There's just more challenges that come along. So I would encourage going for a wet seeded crop in our climate or a plant that has a seed pod.
You are listening to Common Ground Radio on WERU 89.9 FM. I'm Holly Cederholm, and on today's show, I'm talking with Dan Brisebois of Tournesol Cooperative Farm in Canada. Dan's recent book, The Seed Farmer, is a complete guide to growing, using, and selling your own seeds. Common Ground Radio can be heard on the second Thursday of each month at 4 p.m. on 89.9 FM and at WERU.org. It is brought to you by the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. So, for a very beginner, what might be some of your top crop recommendations? If you're like, oh, hey, like you're just starting out, what would be some good ones to think about?
I always start by mentioning tomatoes and peppers, and they're really great choices because you don't have to do anything extra to get the plant to seed. Like, as you think about lettuce, the lettuce head that you harvest, there's no seed in that. You have to wait extra steps. Whereas the tomato or pepper, you have a fruit that has mature seed in it when the fruit is mature. So you don't do anything extra at that. It's just the getting the seed out and then drying it. And as I said, tomatoes barely cross-pollinate. And then peppers, as long as your sweet peppers and hot peppers aren't side by side, you're probably not going to see a problem. So those are what I would say are the gateway crops for growing seed. The next thing I'd recommend is if you grow any flowers, and if you're growing flowers and you're not picking every last bloom, you're probably already seeing some going to seed. And even if you're deadheading them, trying to, keep the plant in production, there's probably still some escaping. And so, like, if you're growing calendula, you've seen seed on your plants. If you're growing stuff like nigellas or poppies, you've seen, like, well, there's the pods out of there, but you open up and you see the seed there. So that's the next thing, is looking at flowers, because you're just like getting the plant to flower is the big thing, and then getting it to seed is like just a few extra weeks or a month more to do that, and you don't have to do a lot extra. So those are the things I would say are the easiest.
So you mentioned that seed crops often take longer or can take longer to reach maturity in the field than their vegetable counterparts, with some exceptions. So what are the implications of that? I'm thinking in terms of like crop rotation or managing humidity to mitigate disease. Like, how should people be thinking about a seed crop in the field versus a vegetable crop that they might be more familiar with?
So the first thing is something I already said, I'm going to repeat, is you've got to plant it early enough. If you grow lettuce, for as a market gardener or as a home gardener, and it goes to flower and then goes to seed, you get frustrated and you're just us. Oh, lettuce goes to seed so easy. I should become a seed company and we'll be rich. But when you're trying to grow lettuce for seed, suddenly you realize it's not going to flower quick enough. And then you get frustrated also. So just planting things earlier will make sure that you can get to the seed in time. The next thing, irrigation is definitely the other big consideration, is it is easiest to do overhead watering, either from sprinklers, or if you're in a smaller space, like from a hose, it's just easier to water that way. And when a lot of plants are young, doesn't matter. So if you have lettuce when it's young, it's fine to overhead water it. But once the lettuce goes to flower and has a tall stem, there's more plant matter to get exposed to the water, more chance of disease being transmitted by the water. And then if you wait a little bit longer and the seed starts to be present or even mature, adding that moisture is kind of like I already talked about how we don't want to wet dry seed. So this is another way to wet it. So avoid overhead watering is for more maturing seed crops is important. And that means either you could put drip tape down underneath, or maybe you just stop watering them once they pass that vegetative phase and they go into a flowering phase. And in our climate, like, we can get away with that. It's not so hot. Like, we're not in like the low hundreds usually. And so it's not so hot that if the plants have no water, they just dry up and turn to a crisp. Like, if they're well established and they've been well watered early on, usually they can survive without moisture later on. Another thing is if you grow your seed crops a little bit further apart, there's more ventilation between them and they'll dry out better, especially like if you consider like after a rain, they'll dry out better in that case. So that's a distinction between like a vegetable crop and a seed crop. And then you did mention rotation. I would say rather than rotation, it's kind of about crop succession. If you have a limited amount of space, you might be counting on, growing a radish early on, and then, 5 weeks later, you take it out and you plant some salad mix, and then when that bolts, you pull it out and put some cilantro down. So if instead you grow lettuce mix early on or lettuce heads early on and let them go to flower, they're not going to be out until mid-August. So that's adding a couple more months. It's cutting out the period of time that you could be growing something else. And then there's one other thing that's more of an issue for market gardeners than home gardeners is some things like if you're growing a brassica, you're not going to be able to harvest every last seed, and some of it's going to shatter to the ground and it's going to germinate next year and it could become a weed problem in the future. So that's a bit where rotation comes in. So if you have had a seed crop somewhere, especially a small seeded crop, the next year you don't want to grow a small seeded crop like carrots or salad mix, especially carrots in that same area, because you don't want it to get overrun by these volunteers. If you're growing potatoes or squash or corn, there's a lot that the plants are bigger, they're more spaced out, there's a lot of space to weed out those volunteers. So those are some of the big differences.
Great, thank you. So you started talking about it not in these terms, but seed selection is a part of seed saving. I'm thinking about that lettuce crop that's going to seed early, and people are like, oh, I could be a seed farmer. But it's like, wait, you might actually not want to select for a bolting lettuce under heat conditions. You might want one that's more tolerant to your summer. So you're ultimately making decisions in the cultivation and harvest of a crop that will impact the genetics of the next generation. And that could be intentional, like saving seeds from the earliest peppers to ripen, or ones that have the most pleasing shape or the sweetest flavor. So, in your book, toward the end of the book, when you have moved out of the seed first mindset and people are more familiar with how to save seed, you're talking about developing a relationship of stewardship, and you dedicate a whole chapter to what it means to be a seed steward. I'm wondering if you could talk about that relationship.
Well, I'll go back 15,000 years. The only reason that we have the seeds we have now is because there's people who've been stewarding them all the way to this point. There are people who have been selecting the varieties and maintaining them and passing them from generation to generation. We've broken that link as market gardeners, especially, as far as gardeners too, but there's more gardeners who keep some of their own seed. And we've passed down that stewardship to larger seed companies. And we have phenomenal seed companies out there. Like this is in no way disparaging of them, but it does break a direct contact with the varieties that we have. And it makes a community less resilient to not have that seed sovereignty and that relationship. And the seed companies, they might not prioritize the same things that we're interested in. And also, if they don't have a market for the varieties that we like, you know, for cultural reasons or other things, they're going to phase it out. So, as gardeners and farmers, we play a specific role where we can keep varieties in existence and we can both, like, well, we can keep them so that they're every time. So, you mentioned selection, and every year when you keep seed, the plants you choose for seed are the ones that are going to, you know, whatever you choose is what you're going to get later on. So we're always adapting the varieties to the changing environment. And so that's one way that a variety keeps up to date with climate change and just changing things. And we're also selecting in function of how we eat or cook or harvest the vegetables. So the stewardship part is both maintaining it so it's available around us and for our own farm. But then ultimately, it's possible, and it's not necessarily going to happen that way, but it's possible that those varieties are picked up by other people and they keep stewarding them. But if you don't steward any varieties, no people have chance of picking those varieties up. So that's kind of the concept behind stewardship. And it's something that, like, you don't have to steward every last variety that you grow. You can steward a few of them. And some might come to you with special stories, either your own, or they might have to do with ancestral crops, or, you know, there's different reasons, or it's something that you've selected on farm and just does better for you because of the selections you've done. And those are the varieties that are valuable and that we don't want to lose the stories and we don't want to lose the genetics.
At your farm, Tournesol Cooperative Farm in Quebec, Canada, what does seed stewardship look like?
I mean, it means a few different things. We have about 240 varieties in our catalog, and I don't know that we're stewards for all of them. Even if we might have a relationship for 20 or 20 years with some of them, I don't know that we're stewards for them on the long term. There's some varieties that we've bred on farm, and I think the varieties that we really like and think we want to keep, like we have different radishes we've bred on farm, some poppies we've just released, some peppers. And I think stewardship for us, for varieties like that, means keeping selecting them and adapting them and making sure they're available. And, if other seed people choose to adopt them, well, that's one way that it can propagate. But that's what stewardship, especially the variety. So these varieties don't exist off of our farm. And if we drop them, they might not be there. And then I know there's are a few seed companies or breeders who are changing their operation, and we picked up some varieties. And if we don't keep those, they might disappear. So I think that's what stewardship looks like on our farm. And I mean, it's always a balance of do people want it in the catalog? And then if people don't want to buy it, well, there's an economic reason not to keep it. But if we personally want to have a relationship with it, we might still keep growing it. So I think that those are all things that we are always evaluating and thinking about.
You mentioned that stewardship could include selecting to adapt to climate change or like to a micro region or a farm. Are these things that you're thinking about year to year as you save seed? Are you making decisions around climate change?
Well, so how you started off, I said that stewardship could include. I would say stewardship does include, because when you're selecting, when you grow a seed crop, you're making a selection. And if you're not making the selection, then the soil is, and the rain is, and the groundhogs are. So there are selections happening. And myself, I often get asked questions about about growing seed and climate change, and I do think it's part of it, but I'm not thinking about that in the field. What I'm looking at is what plants are early, what plants have a lot of fruit, what plants taste good, what plants are doing better. That's what I'm looking at. And so, if we grow a pepper seed crop and we have 100 peppers out there, one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to choose the 10 or 15 pepper plants I like best and flag them. And harvest seed from those to be our stock seed that we're going to use in the future to do the next generation. And then we sell all the rest of the seed because the seed is fine. But I always want the stuff that I'm growing the next year to be better than the last stuff. And then people who buy it from the next year, they're going to have better than the previous generation, but not as good as the one after that. So it's definitely in the context of a changing climate, and it's in a context of, just changing growing conditions. But it's happening without me consciously articulating that when I do it.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I think everyone will have to tune in to your resources, your book, and your podcast to learn more about the techniques of harvesting and storing seed, which we didn't get into, but those are big pieces of it as well. I appreciate you joining me in conversation today.
Thanks so much, Holly, for chatting about this.
This has been Common Ground Radio, which airs on the second Thursday of each month at 4 p.m. on WERU Community Radio 89.9 FM. Archives of previous episodes can be found on WERU.org as well as the WERU app. I'd like to thank Dan for joining me today. I'd also like to thank the show's editor, Claire Boland. Stay tuned for more great programming.